Shift is brought to you by Ricardo. The Ricardo Mobility Summit is April 22nd, featuring Ford CTO Dr. Ken Washington, Microsoft VP Uli Homan, Toyota Motor North America Group VP, Advanced Mobility R&D Monty Kerr, and dozens more, presented virtually in conjunction with Automotive News. Go to ricardo-northamerica.com to register.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Shift, a podcast about mobility. I'm Pete Bigelow, your host and reporter at the Automotive News.
Hey, everybody. This is Leslie Allen, and I am the editor of Shift Magazine.
And it's Alexa St. John, covering tech and suppliers.
Joining us on the podcast today, Matt Cram, Chief Commercial Officer of Arion Supersonic, is going to lay out a supersonic vision of travel that's coming in the not-too-distant future. And talk about how that plays into a global mobility network. But first, Leslie and Alexa, we have some news of our own, I guess, to share a little bit. We have a special report. Leslie, do you want to walk us through what we've all been working on for a while?
Well, it's kind of appropriate, Pete, that we are right around Earth Day, because in the Monday edition of Automotive News, we are presenting a major project on the 25th anniversary of General Motors EV1. Now, the EV1, of course, for those who are not familiar with the car, this was a vehicle that was really, you might say, the grandfather of many of the modern EVs that we're seeing on the road today. This was the first car of the modern era from a major automaker that was built from the ground up with the idea of providing an electric vehicle to consumers. And of course, it had a very short life, but a very remarkable life. And Pete and Alexa were both involved very much in this project. And I'd like to hear your perspectives. I mean, Pete, I know you worked with Hannah Lutz, who is our General Motors reporter, on tracking down the original team members who brought this vehicle to life. So can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. First and foremost, talking to a lot of, 30 plus people who all had a hand in and bringing the EV1 to fruition, a generation ago. And what I think I learned from them was this car was the moonshot of its day. Moonshot being a term we love to throw around a lot nowadays, but this truly was a groundbreaking enterprise in every aspect of its creation. This truly was a space shuttle project for a ground vehicle. And, there weren't too many companies at the time that had the ability to marshal the resources necessary to make it happen. And GM happened to be one who had the resources and the will to kind of start down this road of electric vehicles that we now see kind of proliferating today. But of course, the EV1 was short-lived, as you mentioned, Leslie, but it spawned a generation of enthusiasts who were outraged at the end of the car and the crushing of the car in the early 2000s. And that, of course, spawned the movie Who Killed the Electric Car? Alexa, I know that you talked to the director of that movie, that documentary for this project. What did you learn about the movie itself in that period of time?
That's right. I spoke with Chris Payne, who was the filmmaker of Who Killed the Electric Car. He has since gone on to create Revenge of the Electric Car. And I hear he's working on a third film as well. But exactly what you said is right. There was just pure outrage over what happened with the EV1. And he had been a driver of the vehicle. He told me that, as soon as he got in that car, he was sold. He was sold on the technology. He was sold on the environmental benefits. He was really just sold on the vision that GM had created through that vehicle. And so when he no longer had his EV1, him and many, many others began protesting. They held something called a funeral at Hollywood Cemetery to kind of commemorate the EV1. So it really hit a nerve in a lot of people when GM canceled the program. And when he represented all of that in his film, he faced quite a bit of backlash. There was a bit of controversy. GM seemed unhappy with how the situation was represented, which, you know, I think is some of what sparked the making of the second film. But regardless, I was really amazed, you know, hearing his perspective and his experience from the time at how passionate people really were about this project and, you know, how much they do point to it as a sign of the future. And now, you know, what's to come today.
That's right, Alexa. I think the film really did capture that outrage well. Of course, now, even this week, we do see GM committing to an electric future. You know, GM is back on board. And there was some news just this week on the electric vehicle front in that regard, especially with their aspiration to electrify their light duty lineup by 2035. Leslie, can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah. And I think this ties in very nicely with our entire discussion on EV1, because one thing that I thought was interesting in the story that you guys did was people said that General Motors could have been the Tesla of its day if it had stuck with this project. But I think GM has more than made up for that with its really strong push into EVs. And you, as you know, last year, I believe, they made a deal with LG Chem, and they're working together on these super long-range batteries called Ultium batteries. And just as we're speaking today, GM has made an announcement that it's building a second plant to make these Ultium cells. It's going to be building that in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and they're expecting to create about 1,300 new jobs. So there's no doubt that General Motors is very serious about this electrified future.
For anyone interested in our EV1 project, you can go to autonews.com/EV1 and find 8 or 9 stories, 4 podcasts, a lot of videos. It's a big package. Hope you get a chance to check it out. And, you know, ultimately, I think the legacy of the EV1 is that it was a car that was ahead of its time. Electric technology was built and it was probably a generation early, and we're now bearing that fruit. Some might think that supersonic travel is something, again, that is ahead of its time. But segueing to our conversation with Matt Cram today, he will tell you it is not. It is right around the corner. Ariane has plans to build its aircraft and test it in the next few years and deliver it to customers by 2027. So in terms of a generation, that seems right around the corner. And perhaps without further ado, why don't we go to our conversation with Matt Cram, Chief Commercial Officer at Ariane Supersonic. Matt, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. Good to have you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, we've not discussed supersonic flight on our podcast before, so I'm hoping that you can kind of just kick this off by telling us about the company and what it is exactly that you're hoping to do.
Okay. Oh, great. Thanks. At Ariane, we are building the next generation of global mobility networks. Our goal is ambitious, is to connect any 2 points on the world within 3 hours. And our starting point is supersonic flight.
That goal of connecting any point on the planet within 3 hours, that sounds ambitious is an understatement. It obviously comes with high capital costs, long lead time, and, you know, I don't know, I want to say on the threshold of possibility. Why this particular challenge that seems arduous?
You know, it's a great question. In some ways, it is a moonshot. But I think it's those kind of goals that you have to set those kind of goals to achieve them. So we look at it. We look at the AS2, a supersonic business jet, as the first start. We recently announced the AS3, which will be a Mach 4, which is approximately a 3,000 mile an hour airplane. And that will, you know, what's unique about that airplane is it will make West Coast to Asia a day trip. So it'll do LA to Tokyo in less than 3 hours. So it's, you know, and we're well on the way to developing both of those aircraft. So when we look at the total ecosystem, and connecting the various parts, urban air mobility, supersonic aircraft, eventually hypersonic aircraft, there is, you know, it is a 20 plus year roadmap that we have, but we think it's very doable.
I want to ask you a lot about the AS2 and AS3, but maybe before we get to that, I'm hoping you can give us a little bit of a history lesson on supersonic flight in terms of, we have Chuck Yeager breaking the sound barrier in 47. The Concorde launches about the same time. I think its first flight was about the same time as the moon landing in 69. Mm-hmm. Passenger flight a few years later. Why did all that go away for a while?
Great question. Yeah, you know, when you look at the Concorde, it was really pretty remarkable, right? What the Concorde represented, you know, Mach 2, New York, London, you know, 3,000 nautical mile range, a little bit longer than that, based on the technology in the 60s. The first flight was late 60s. Revenue service was, you know, early 70s. And it, you know, stayed, you know, in commercial service through, I believe, 2003. So, you know, any discussion on supersonics is really going to start around the Concorde. Incredibly bold, incredibly noble, a lot of lessons learned for us. So when we look at the Concorde, you know, it's funny, it's hard to find somebody who flew on the Concorde and doesn't think about it, you know, nostalgically, right? They really enjoy that experience. It's something that they remember fondly. And we're not looking to recreate the Concorde, but we are looking back at some of the lessons learned. The Concorde was very noisy. Some of the regulations that we're dealing with today were actually put in place because of the noise that the Concorde made. It used afterburning engines. It was very expensive to operate, you know, required state subsidies. And ultimately, only 14 were ever put in revenue service. So we look at those, we look at some of those lessons and understand that to be successful, supersonic flight has to be sustainable. So that is absolutely bedrock in everything we do.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the state support. Obviously, Britain and France contributed to the Concorde. The Soviets had the Tupolev for a while and supported that. And then here in the present day, within the last few weeks, President Biden has talked about supersonic flight as happening within the next decade. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's anything in his infrastructure plan or you know, in other ways, is there any federal support that you see as necessary to, you know, either directly subsidize the aircraft development or more broadly the infrastructure it needs to operate in?
Right. Yeah. No. We were encouraged by President Biden's remarks. We've actually received really good support from the FAA over the last several years. We've seen, kind of a loosening of some of the regulations that would constrain us. I'm not aware of anything in the current bill, directly related to, subsidizing the development of the AS2 or other supersonic aircraft. But there is a lot in there, regarding infrastructure, which obviously we will benefit from as well the rest of the industry. And what I think is really interesting is the support for sustainable aviation fuels. So that's something that's incredibly important to us as well as the rest of the industry and humanity as well. That's something that we fully support. The AS2 will be the first aircraft that will, with GE Aviation, who's developing our engine, the Affinity engine, it'll be the first new engine that can take 100% sustainable aviation fuels. So, we're anything that we can do, anything that the administration can do to support, the development of SAF, we fully support.
So to take your example of the Concorde and the afterburners before, obviously very, the equivalent of, the gas guzzling SUV in the aviation.
Right.
And now you're talking about something that is much more sustainable and environmentally friendly. And that was one of the big downfalls of the Concorde in supersonic flight the first time around.
Right. Yeah. When you really, when you think about it, our biggest constraint from a design perspective is landing and takeoff, right? So when you optimize for supersonic speed at, 50 plus thousand feet, that's one thing, but you got to be able to take off and land as well, within the existing noise regulations. So that's always been, fundamental to us that, we're not looking to roll anything back. We will fit comfortably within the regulations that any new commercial or ultra long range business aircraft will be required to fit into today. So, at stage five noise regulations. So we're not looking for any relief there.
That sounds very, I think that's one of the things that, people who know a little bit about the first go around of supersonic remember is that boom.
Right.
That led to that stage five regulation. So you're saying that that's ancient history.
Right. So, yeah. So there's kind of the landing and takeoff noise. So we will fit comfortably within those regulations. We'll be similar to a 737 taking off. So there'll be no afterburning engines, no boom on takeoff or landing or anything like that. And then once we're operating, we have what we've developed is called boomless cruise. Right? That's the ability to fly supersonically over land without a boom striking the ground. So that's different, but that's an additional technology that we are incorporating into the AS2.
So that kind of gives you, as you mentioned before, you could do LA to Asia in 3 hours, maybe New York to London. Now, theoretically, you can do New York to LA in, mere minutes.
Well, so the AS2, the AS3. So the AS2, if we're allowed to operate supersonically over land without a boom striking the ground, we'll be able to connect New York, LA in less than 3 hours. With the ASJ.
Let me loop back to the role of the federal government in some fashion. I know you have a partnership with NASA's Langley Research Center that's existed for a long time. And I know that there's recent updates to that. So what all are you doing with Langley, and how is that helping you develop supersonic technology?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. We actually have, Aireon has actually existed since 2003. That's when it was originally formed. During that time, we have tested several different designs and have partnered with NASA several times on the development and evaluation of different aircraft designs. I believe this is our third different collaboration with NASA. And I'd also mention that we have a technologies group based in Palo Alto, California. They have a pretty unique relationship with NASA as well, and collaborate on some software design tools that we have used to there's not a lot of design tools out there, modeling supersonic flight. So we come up with our own in conjunction with NASA that we actually do license to third parties. So we've had a long history of working with NASA. The latest agreement is really studying kind of the Mach 3 to Mach 5 region. No one knows supersonics better than NASA. So coordinating with them on kind of what they've learned and some of the propulsion systems that they're familiar with is beneficial for us.
And would you anticipate, or do you have plans for obviously commercial flights? Are you doing anything in the military realm, or do you have kind of business plans in that roadmap you mentioned that would be for military purposes as well?
We do. The AS2 it's a remarkable airplane. It is roughly the size of a 737. It can fly 4,200 nautical miles at Mach 1.4. If you look at, say, the F-35, for example, after a couple hundred miles, it gets thirsty and needs to refuel. We can also do 5,000 nautical miles at 0.95, so a little bit below Mach. So when you look at the, so from a DoD perspective, there is some really interesting opportunities there. Clearly, high-speed transport for, senior officials. There's also some other opportunities that we're exploring as well.
I know you've mentioned the AS2 and AS3 a few times, and I just want to make sure I have a clear picture. When do you expect each to kind of reach the market? Where are they in terms of flight tests right now?
Right. So the AS2, that's our starting point, supersonic business jet. We recently broke ground on the facility that we'll be building the airplane in Melbourne, Florida. So the first building's going up, will be going up this year. Pieces coming together 2023, first flight 25, and first delivery to a customer in 27. We're pretty comfortable with those milestones. AS3, we haven't released a lot about that, but we have said that the first flight will be this decade and entry into service will be early 2030s.
So on AS2, you mentioned first customer 2027, and you have some partnerships in place where some customers are already lining up to buy that particular aircraft.
We are. Yeah, no, we've been really, really pleased with the market's acceptance of the airplane. So our launch customer was Flexjet. They signed an order for 20 airplanes back in 2015. So they were, fairly visionary, kind of, looking ahead a little bit. We've been working with them over the years on you know, incorporating their feedback into the aircraft, which obviously is hugely beneficial to us. Over the past year, we've announced several additional customers, including NetJets, which is, you know, between Flexjet and NetJets, you know, those are the two largest fractional operators. So both, you know, strong validations of the program. And we've we currently have approximately $11 billion backlog, which when you think about where we are in the development cycle, you know, most OEMs don't start accepting orders until there's an aircraft either in production or not production, but in, has rolled out or in flight test. We're still several years away from that and have almost 100 orders right now. So it really shows how eager the market is for a supersonic business jet.
How many passengers aboard AS2?
8 to 10. So it's a two club. It's actually a very spacious cabin. The height is 6'5". So that's actually very, very comparable with other, actually it exceeds most other ultra long range aircraft. And the width is approximately 8 feet wide, which again, for an ultra long range aircraft is pretty good. So, you know, from a passenger perspective, we'll let the passengers kind of select their interior and how they want to configure it. But we'll be able to accommodate, like I said, 8 to 10 passengers pretty comfortably.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Matt to hear a word from our sponsor.
The Ricardo Mobility Summit Convergence is April 22nd, featuring Ford CTO Ken Washington, Microsoft VP Uli Homan, Toyota Motor Group VP Advanced Mobility R&D Monty Kerr, and dozens of other amazing thought leaders across transport, business, defense, government, private equity, and software. Convergence, presented virtually in conjunction with Automotive News, spotlights the best and brightest minds from companies across America, sharing insights and forecasts regarding megatrends that affect us all. In what direction will the convergence of global policy, tech advancements, and investment travel? What will this new enviro-based reality look like next year? In 2050? Learn how some of the sharpest, most informed leaders in the industry plan to attack this mobility riddle. The Ricardo Mobility Summit Convergence, April 22nd, beginning at 11 a.m. Eastern. By combining a blend of one-on-one discussions, roundtable sessions, and new product demos from Ricardo, Convergence addresses the challenges and complexities throughout the transportation sector. It's a showcase for hot topics such as the evolution of propulsion, software, connectivity, autonomy, and digitization. For more information about the Ricardo Mobility Summit Convergence, go to ricardo-northamerica.com. That's ricardo-northamerica.com.
Now, back to our conversation with Matt Cram of Arion Supersonic.
I'm going to switch gears for a moment on you with a big picture sort of question.
Sure.
Here we are in COVID times and we're not traveling. The world feels, like we're very squared away from each other, far apart. With COVID, does anything change long term with this idea that you're going to connect us all within a matter of 3 hours anywhere around the globe?
Great question. I don't think so. You know, when you look at the last year, clearly, you know, last February and March were, just eye-opening. Everything just stopped, including business aviation, commercial aviation. I mean, you know, they both fell off a cliff, literally. Since then, commercial aviation has come back. It's certainly, it's certainly growing. Look at business aviation. Demand has actually skyrocketed. Many of the operators, you know, back in February, March, April of last year were really struggling to see how they were going to make it through. And 2020 ended up actually not being horrible for them, just based on the strong growth in the third and fourth quarters. So I think it's really a testament to people's desire to want to travel. Whether it's for business, whether it's for pleasure, I don't think you're going to see people want to isolate. I think you're going to want to see people get out more.
Maybe it helps. I'm thinking, you know, in ground transportation, we've seen a migration from public transits to privately owned vehicles or shared vehicles. And I'm curious, is there a similar effect where some of the people getting off, commercial aircraft last year still needed to travel, looked to business aviation as a safer means to get where they needed to go?
Yeah, I think we definitely saw that. So as the commercial airlines, as they contracted, you know, they are offering less service to less locations. So that, you know, I think we had a couple things going on. I think people do feel safer traveling, you know, in business aviation. There's just, quite frankly, there's just much fewer touch points. When you look at, you know, private FBOs, smaller airports, you know, direct, you know, from point to point instead of going through, you know, various hubs and layovers. And there's also, like I said, the airlines really did contract. And so there was just less service. And, you know, before the pandemic, there was some pretty interesting statistics that, you know, roughly 90% of the people who could afford private aviation were not in private aviation. They chose to fly commercially. So there was, you know, when you saw the airlines contract and when you saw people become very concerned about, you know, COVID, you did see not a flight, but you did see a migration into business aviation.
At the outset of our conversation here, you used kind of a curious phrase of you're not merely building aircraft, but you're a global mobility, you're creating a global mobility network. What does that mean? And what's the difference between being a, you know, supersonic aircraft manufacturer and that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we look at it, and this is kind of a bad analogy, but we don't think of ourselves as building an airplane, giving it to the customer, and then providing some service, but, you know, kind of just giving them the aircraft and letting them go do their thing. We almost look at it as speed as a service. And so we want to integrate, you know, kind of the larger ecosystem and take people from where they are to where they want to be, right? So it's not necessarily airport to airport. It's, you know, downtown Manhattan to Mayfair. And we want to optimize all of that around speed and efficiency. So we've established a set of kind of initial partnerships with folks like Electra, Electra.aero. They're developing a ESTL, so a short takeoff and landing vehicle, a little bit different than, you know, vertical takeoff and landing, but, you know, a similar idea that they'll be able to get into and out of smaller spaces, not necessarily be confined to airports, and be able to really help condense the time from where you are to the airport. And then on the other side, from the airport to where you want to go.
That's so interesting. I'm curious to, you know, what's your general thought on the business opportunity right now? We'll just call it, you know, VTOL. Is that almost a harder challenge than what you're doing just because of the nature of the infrastructure that's required? At least there's airports that are already built.
Right. That is fascinating. I think it's absolutely fascinating what's going on. I was at a conference when we still had conferences. I was at a conference, you know, a year and a half ago. And I want to say it was something like there's over 300 different eVTOL or advanced air mobility manufacturers, designers, developers out there. And that number had doubled from 2017. I mean, it has, you know, so there's just an explosion in that space. They're not all going to, there's going to be some winners. There's going to, you know, not everyone's going to quote unquote make it. But I think there's, you know, just there's such a convergence of new technologies. And I think that, you know, as those technologies mature, I think you're going to see, you know, just support from, you know, different regional and urban areas to reduce congestion off the roads and get people from where they are to where they want to be, you know, much, much quicker.
So you're taking passengers, not just airport to airport, but truly point to point, like you said, with partners like that. I'm curious if you would ever foresee a partner in the automotive realm to do similar things. Maybe it's, you know, taking a car from the airport to their destination versus the urban air mobility, you know, urban aircraft, so to speak.
Right. No, I think so. I think so. I, you know, from my perspective, when we look at, we call it Aireon Connect, right? Where we're kind of integrating this ecosystem. And the way we think of it, you know, we're taking multiple modes of transportation, including a supersonic business jet, and just condensing the amount of time it takes to get from point A to point B. I'm indifferent as to whether it's a eVTOL or a black car, or, you know, a nice car. What we're looking for is, you know, the quickest solutions from you know the different points. So whether it be Hyperloop, whether it be eVTOLs, whether it be eSTOLs, whether it be cars, you know, certain airports, depending on where you are, the most efficient solution may be on the ground. That, you know, other airports are 30, 40 miles from the city center. So in those cases, it would make sense to use an eVTOL. You know, we look at it, you know, kind of on a global basis, in each region, say New York, London, Dubai, may require a different solution.
It's very interesting that, to borrow the phrase that you used before, which I think maybe perfectly sums it up, you're in the business of speed as a service.
Right. Right. Absolutely. So you think about, a simple example, but if, using conventional travel methods, it's 8 to 9 hours to go downtown Manhattan to downtown London. With an AS2, we will save you 2 hours transatlantic, right? That's a great route for us. It's all over water. We can go supersonic the whole way. Conventional aircraft will take 6 hours. We'll be able to do it in less than 4. But if you're still stuck in traffic for 90 minutes on both sides, it just takes away, it just degrades from the experience. It makes it a full day trip. Integrating eVTOL will save potentially, you might be able to do a trip in 30 minutes from downtown Manhattan to the airport. It also allows you to use different airports. So instead of being constrained to the closest airport, because, it's just so much further for the car to go, as the crow flies, an eVTOL can get out to other airports pretty quickly and actually help facilitate a quicker takeoff for the AS2. So when we look at, integrating the entire ecosystem, we see New York, London as, a 5-hour trip instead of a 9-hour trip.
Maybe along those same lines of using other airports, and the eVTOL can use them. What's the runway length that you need to land an AS2 on?
Approximately 7,500 feet, which is consistent with what you'd see for other ultra long range aircraft.
Gotcha. Okay. So nothing extra long needed.
No, any commercial airport will be just fine. Most general aviation airports will be just fine as well.
Earlier, you mentioned hypersonic speeds, and just for mm-hmm. our listeners, can you define what the threshold is between supersonic and hypersonic, and do both have passenger applications, or is the latter just kind of more for missiles and military purposes?
No, I think the generally accepted answer for threshold for hypersonic is Mach 5. I believe when you're into that speed range, it's considered hypersonic. So when we think of the AS3, a Mach 4.3 airplane, it's a little less than hypersonic. It's kind of right on that cusp. But that's a speed that, we have kind of line of sight into engine solutions that will work, material properties that will work. And, we're comfortable that we can, have a prototype ready by the end of the decade.
Gotcha. And you mentioned earlier, GE is who you've been working with on the engine design in particular. And how long has that taken to work with them and create a modern day engine for supersonic travel?
Great question. Actually, we conducted a pretty extensive evaluation of the various options, 2015, 2016, 2017. We work with all of the different engine OEMs, here in the United States, as well as several internationally, and eventually selected GE. I believe we actually signed an agreement with them 2017, 2018, and have been working with them on the Affinity engine for the AS2 ever since. So they've been, a great partner for us. And it really is, it's a very strong collaboration between us.
Okay. And from a manufacturing perspective, you have a new global headquarters in Melbourne, Florida. Is that where you're going to make the AS2 as well?
So in Melbourne, Florida will be the home of the AS2. We made that announcement last year. We broke ground December of last year. We will start seeing buildings really go up later this year. And that's where we will design and develop the AS2. It's too soon to say yet on the AS3 where it will be.
Did Melbourne stick out just because you've kind of got that NASA space shuttle talent that's around? And is that kind of like an aerospace talent hub, and where you felt that was the reason, was that the big draw for Melbourne?
It was. Yeah. We conducted a nationwide search. We evaluated over a dozen potential locations, on both coasts as well as the Gulf. And eventually, based on our requirements, Melbourne was a clear winner. So they've got a strong engineering base there, a history of innovation with all of the NASA ties, obviously. And then, being so close to water will really help facilitate our flight test program. So, you know, with that, and then quite frankly, just the amount of support we received from the state, the county, the airport there, we've already opened our first office at the airport and have approximately 25 individuals working there now.
I know Ariane is not the only company working on developing supersonic aircraft. Can you just kind of delineate, I don't know if you want to pick a particular competitor or just keep it general, but what separates you guys from the competition right now? I'll make it a two-part one. Is there room for more than one player?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. There are a lot of relatively new entrants into the space, which I think kind of speaks to the strength of the market, right? And kind of the convergence of technology that now make this, you know, much more doable than it was just a few years ago. From our perspective, what I think differentiates us, we have great investors. We have very patient investors. Bob Bass founded Ariane back in 2003, is still a major shareholder. We had the Boeing investment in 2019. Obviously, they're the world's largest aerospace company, so that was incredibly beneficial to us. We have a strong relationship with GE and about 25, 30 other aerospace partners. So we've gone out and identified, the very best, the Honeywells, Safrans, Potes, Collins. I mean, the people, the system, subsystems, components you would expect. We have relationships with them. We have agreements with them. We're working with them on designing and developing the airplane. From a customer perspective, like I said earlier, we have over 90 orders, $11 billion backlog. So I really think, when I think of it, I think that not to denigrate any of the activities that others are doing in the space, we certainly applaud, any advancement in supersonics. We feel like we're in the lead, and it's just based on, strong investors, strong suppliers, and strong market support.
Matt, what's your background and, how did you kind of find yourself, in this position where you're pursuing supersonic travel?
That's a great question. I actually started my career at Boeing. So, there's kind of a saying that once you kind of get bit with the aviation bug, it's hard to get away from it. So I was fortunate to work in a variety of different positions at Boeing, spent some time as an attorney in private practice, supporting ultra high net worth individuals, airlines, buying from Boeing and Airbus. I did that for approximately 10 years. And then in 2015, joined Ariane. And I've been fortunate to have a variety of positions. I was a GC for a little while. I'm currently head of sales, marketing, sustainability. And really it's really kind of just that whole confluence of different experiences that have led me to where I am today.
When you say you were bit by the aviation bug, are you a pilot as well, or did you just stick with the business side of the legal side of the operation?
Right. It's funny. I actually started when I was at Boeing. I had the opportunity to take discounted flying lessons, and I was doing that. And right before I was getting ready to go do my final testing, I was accepted into law school, and I actually ended up getting accepted kind of at the last moment. And so I had to choose between finishing my private pilot's license or jumping into law school. And I ended up deciding, well, I'll jump over here, go to school for a couple of years, and then finish up my pilot's license later. And it's still on my list of things to do.
Last question for you. I think behind you, I see a fairly extensive bookshelf. And, from time to time, we like to pick our guest's brain on what they're reading, or is there a key book that you've read that's really influenced you, be it in the aviation realm or beyond? If you were going to recommend one of those for us, what would it be?
That's a good question, actually. Yeah, I do love to read. Just top of mind, I just finished Shoe Dog the other day, the autobiography by Phil Knight. Absolutely fascinating. So I grew up in Oregon, was a runner, ran in college, have been competing since then. So just kind of the history of Nike and how they got started. Really, it was just eye-opening. Just how difficult it was for him to get his idea, kind of to move it forward. He spent years working two jobs before Nike was ultimately successful. As I read that book, there are so many parallels between, you know, what I think he went through in the 70s and 80s, and in many cases, what Arianne has gone through over the past couple of decades. So I found it very enjoyable and would recommend it.
Years-long roadmap, I think, it requires patience in either sphere.
Right. Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you just kind of look at these companies and just think, wow, they just, snap your fingers and one day they were there, and that's not the case. So I know there's, numerous other, companies that would have similar examples. That's the one that just kind of came top of mind.
Great. Matt, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Big thanks again to Matt for joining us on the podcast. Really interesting conversation there. But who do we have coming up next week, Pete?
Next week, Alexa, we will be talking to Liza Dixon, who is a researcher in the human-machine interaction area, who has coined the term autonawashing. So if you don't know what that is yet, stay tuned to hear about autonawashing next week. And it's going to be a really terrific conversation. But that is it for today. Thanks so much to our listeners. Thank you to our producer, Eric Jones. And we will be back again next week.